The chances of China falling into a full-scale, quarter-century-long Japan-style stagnation are pretty low. But it's possible, and it's definitely worth watching.
To understand geopolitics, you must have the freedom to be honest.
The More Freedom Foundation podcast. Hello, Rob. How are you this week?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you doing, Rory?
I'm doing very well. I've heard that you have a very important mission to do today.
I do. I want to record this quickly so I can go out and see if the director of the new Mission Impossible movie manages to kill Tom Cruise. I'm very excited about it.
I don't think he has.
Yeah,
What's the big stunt? Because there's always a thing that nearly kills Tom. What is it in this film?
Well, I think we've all seen it in the previews. I think he rides a bike off a cliff.
Okay.
And I saw a TikTok, Rory, that indicated that they had to shoot it multiple times.
This is the film where Tom Cruise shouted at everyone because they weren't following COVID protocols. Is that right?
Wow, I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, no, I remember that. That was a whole thing. You know, it's funny. Like, I think I, as sort of like an anti, like, countercultural kid growing up or whatever, like, I've always been Tom Cruise, that guy. Yeah. But man, as he like, as he rounds into his 60s, it's more like a go Tom. He's like becoming a.
Well, there's a theory that he's trying to like kill himself, but like on set.
Wow, that's
but that's just a theory. Any of this filmed in China?
I have no idea, man.
Okay, because it seems like that phase is over. Do you remember every film was trying to be like a secret China film as well?
Oh yeah, well, of course.
And I think they've kind of went and we'll just stick to America and Europe if they're in the mood.
I'm sure there's some China flattering in this Mission Impossible film as well, for sure. But that's a great segue that I didn't catch, Rory. I was just. You're putting this segue gold and, you know, segue pearls in front of this swine who's not picking it up.
Up for the El Salvador episode.
Oh, was that a particularly bad segue?
It was a bad segue.
These things go in my, you know, go in my, go in my. I present and then I forget about everything. Yes, we're talking about China. Specifically, we're talking about the Chinese economy. Last week, we went into the U.S. economy in some detail. Who knows? By the time we're uploading this, the U.S. economy narrative could be flaming failure. Who knows? But when we recorded that episode that should have gone up last week, it seemed like the U.S. economy was doing pretty well. And as we are recording this episode, a week before it's going to air, it seems like the Chinese economy is doing not so well.
We've hit peak Chinese people.
Peak Chinese economy sentiments, I think, would be a good...
No, the population is now in decline.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right. That is a huge aspect of what's going on in China. Now, I do want to say, and I think the reason we've done these two episodes on the U.S. economy and the Chinese economy is because we now have two economies matter immensely, inordinately, for the world economy in general. If we want a happy, healthy world economy, we need both the U.S. and China to be firing on, not necessarily all cylinders, but one of them's got to be firing on all cylinders, and the other one's got to be doing okay.
And it's nice if the EU are doing okay, too.
Yes, it is nice if the EU is doing okay, but unfortunately, now the EU's main indicator is how are China and the U.S. doing. And I think, I don't want to minimize the EU. It is still an immensely powerful economic organization and has the potential... just as the U.S. does,
implement some trade sanctions on China?
But I think on a number of topics, can we say get their collective heads out of their asses? Can we say that on the podcast?
I'll let you have this one. I'm quite mean to Rob. If for everyone listening, I don't let him swear.
But I think the United States has to do the same. You know, getting our heads out of our collective rear ends. How about that? And I think Europe has tremendous potential. But the thing is that I think for the rest of our lives, what happens in the U.S. economy, what happens in the Chinese economy are what matters. And I think that there's a lot of doomsaying across the political perspective, whether you're a massive Washington, D.C. war hawk or a big America hater or whatever, like, everybody loves to talk about potential disaster scenarios for the United States, potential disaster scenarios for China.
Economy will collapse in 27 days because of housing crisis.
Exactly. Yeah. That sort of thing. And don't get me wrong, I do think that in the near term, over the next decade or so, China has probably a more serious crisis or two in the offing than the United States does. But on the other side of that crisis, there will still be a China, and it will still be the second largest economy in the world. Also, another aspect of that is, like, if China really did go the full Peter Zeihan route and, like, implode in some incredibly dramatic way, like, the economic consequences for the entire world,
oh yeah, be terrifying,
would be horrific. Horrific.
There's also a lot of stuff other countries would have to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that logistics alone. I know it sounds silly, but I'm surrounded by computers here and PlayStations, and they're all made in China. And I know these are considered frivolous things, but there will be a lot more important things that will be at the click of a finger will have to be made elsewhere.
Yeah, and just there's that, which is tremendously important, but also just like, if you were to just take Chinese demand out of the economy, everything would fall.
They still buy it a lot as well.
Yeah, everything would fall apart. But I don't think there's any serious danger of that happening. I think absolutely there's a potential for serious government crises in China or what have you. But this idea that we're going to just jump back to 1995 and China's just not going to be a factor anymore is a complete fantasy. But all that said, I do think it's important to consider one particular dynamic I think we're going to talk about today, which is China turning into Japan? And this is not, is China all of a sudden going to develop a world historically significant anime industry? No, I'm talking about the economic path that Japan took from the 1980s until today, more or less, and the economic situation that China may or may not be in at this moment. This is a tremendously important question, something that policymakers have been worrying about for a decade now, and is now a very present worry. Because as I pointed out, Chinese demand is incredibly important. One of the great things that's been happening this year is oil and gas prices being as low as they are. And that's entirely because of stagnation of demand from China. Everybody was expecting Chinese post-COVID zero reopening to be this extraordinary economic boom, and it just hasn't been. So oil and gas
just
prices...
Just like we had with America, where it went up to something like 6%.
Exactly. We were expecting like a massive boost in GDP growth in 2023, and it's now clear that that's just not happening. That means we've got oil and gas prices are low, which are great for everybody. But that also means that demand for a whole range of commodities that a lot of developing countries rely on selling is lower than it, you know, than it could have been. It also means that all manner of services that we're talking about the EU provides a tremendous amount of manufactured goods and services to China, more and more now that the United States and China are falling out a bit, that demand just isn't there. China is truly going to do what Japan did in the 1980s, 90s, and 2010s. The world economy is in some serious trouble. To review what happened in the when I was a youngster, when I was in the 80s, Japan, and to a lesser extent Germany, looked like they were inheriting the future. You know, you'd have magazine articles be like, who really won World War II? Saying stuff like that, because their economies were so impressive. It was expected that by like the mid-90s, the Japanese economy would be bigger than the U.S. economy. The Japanese were buying up all kinds of beloved U.S. cultural institutions like Rockefeller Center and like movie studios and this, that, and the other thing. And then that stopped.
But this is where we get a lot of cyberpunk. That's why it's got a very Asian-Japanese feel. The idea was the future would be dominated by the Japanese. So
yes,
that's why Blade Runner looks the way it does.
Exactly.
It was part of a big panic in the 1980s. You also have a lot of Japanese automobiles and motorbikes coming over as well.
It's nothing like what it wasn't anything like it is today with anime and whatnot. And that's, I think that's actually kind of an interesting dynamic, but like just ninjas or just all aspects of Japanese culture. And this is a dynamic that goes back to the late 1800s, but in the 80s in particular, as the Japanese economy seemed to be taking over the world, this was an omnipresent part of U.S. and European pop culture. And then it stopped. There was a tremendous property crash. towards the end of the 80s and the early 90s in Japan, and Japan entered literal decades of stagnation.
Even though to an outsider, it's still one of the most wealthiest countries in the world, it was in, you know, a recession for, what, 20 years?
If China were to enter like a Japan-type dynamic, it would be tremendously damaging for the world's economy and whatnot. But I think that anime example I was just talking about provides, like, it doesn't mean, even if China goes full Japan, it doesn't mean that China's going to stop being influential. It doesn't mean that China's going to stop growing in influence. One of the aspects of the whole wolf warrior diplomacy, blah, 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 was China just not knowing how to handle itself. As China stops being the inevitable future of everything, they're going to get a little more humble, and they're going to learn how to do things better, diplomatically, culturally, public diplomacy, this, that, and the other thing. So
will the rest of the world know how to treat China?
Sure, but I feel like the rest of the world has a much better sense of diplomacy than the current generations of Chinese leadership does. So I think there's a much greater scope for China figuring out how to better use the very new position of wealth and power that it's in. So I think the anime example we're talking about. So Japan is nowhere near the topic of general level pop culture fascination that it was in the 1980s. But I'm a huge comic book nerd. But I was a huge comic book nerd who was, you know, came of, you know, nerdy comic book guy age in the late 80s. And, you know, I guess my adolescence, I graduated high school in 1998. So say 1987 to 1998. Anime was, you know, we knew what Akira was, but we didn't have, so anime is the Japanese cartoons and manga is the Japanese comic books. I was a huge comic book nerd, but like I was too old to fall. Akira was the only manga broadly available at comic book shops in the 1980s and the early 1990s. So maybe that changed by the end of the 1990s. So Japan, incredibly stagnated Japan that has become a watchword for economic stagnation and economic screw-ups or what have you for the past 30 years, has completely taken over, like, comic book nerds who are like 10 years younger than me, everything was manga, everything was Japanese stuff. That's the main thing. And yeah, I guess, you know, the superheroes, they make some movies about them, and Marvel or DC are fun or whatever. So I think this idea that if China goes down the Japan route, does not mean that all of a sudden, you know, China disappears. It just means that China has to get smarter. China will remain. I did a short a little while ago. It's like China's not going anywhere. Even if they don't figure anything out and go into full-on economic stagnation, they are going to continue to be a massive, massive part of the world economy.
Well, speaking of culture, my mother's been obsessed with the story of Yangtze Palace, which is apparently a 70-episode epic. So I think we're going to be getting a lot more Chinese films and TVs to come. Like, they're just here to stay. And one important part is, apparently throughout human history, China has always roughly been about 15% of the economy, and India's been another 15%. So it's likely they'll just go back to, you know, a historical default.
I think that's quite likely. Maybe a little bit lower, because the United States...
is in the game.
Yeah, the United States is the North America did not. I don't think ever really figured very heavily in those calculations.
No,
no offense to the Maya or the Aztec, who were very impressive.
Oh, the geography was really against them, but that's another topic.
Another topic. That cultural domination. About 10 years ago, I think it was House of Flying Daggers, A Hero. There were these other films that were just, I was just blown away by these films. And I was like, wow, like, man, if China, you know, China's got us, like, these movies are better and more sincere and more earnest and more interesting than anything I'd felt like I was seeing from Hollywood at that point. And I really thought that, like, China was on its way. You know, there was that sci-fi writer that everybody was super excited about 10 years ago. And I've actually been surprised by how little cultural impact China has had recently.
Oh, yeah,
and I
wonder, you sort of thought that was the floodgates opening?
Exactly. And I wonder if maybe there's been some kind of conscious gatekeeping in the United States. Keeping things from going is huge now that we all officially hate China now.
Also games as well, as the likes of Genshin Impact has slowly become more popular. Like, this was something that China had been closed off to computer games, or, you know, video games for decades. So this was one that had been, you know, a slow franchise from the 90s, which is now vastly popular worldwide.
I don't know anything about video games. So you're saying that Chinese video games are becoming a bigger thing?
They're getting there. It's something else. Japan, for those who don't know, completely dominates. So both PlayStation and Nintendo are Japanese companies, and a huge amount of games are Japanese. And slowly we're seeing more and more Chinese. Still a wee bit derivative at the moment, but they're definitely getting there.
Huh. So to get back into the sort of the meat of what I'm talking about, is China becoming Japan? Is China going to fall into a similar level of economic stagnation?
And it's also trying to make cars very similar to Japan. They want, is it five car brands they want to be internationally recognized, and they'll all be electric?
I think they've had tremendous success just really over the past 18 months. Like, if you look at the car production numbers, it's pretty extraordinary. But so the discussion coming after, I just want to say I'm pretty indebted to a recent Odd Lots podcast episode interviewing Richard Koo, I believe his name was, and a Money and Macro video on Japan's past 40 years, essentially. I love Money and Macro. It's a good good place to dive in, good YouTube channel to dive in. And he did a great video, half an hour long, on the decline of an economic superpower, or what have you, on Japan, that I found very informative. So the concern is that China's going to do something very similar to what Japan did, which is essentially catch up all the way, catch up or even exceed or what have you, technologically, and then just sort of run out of runway and just sort of stop growing economically as in his breakneck way, as it had done. And I think that an important dynamic here that is underappreciated, and Money and Macro actually contributes, he doesn't think this is as big a deal, but it seems pretty transparently to be a very big deal to me, that is similar to what China's going through, but it is also quite different to what China's going through, is that the United States in the 1980s essentially decided to kneecap Japan.
Before that, it had massively helped Japan after the war.
Absolutely. And those dynamics are quite similar to what's going on with China today. I think a lot of people describe it, and there's some truth to this, that there's some kind of natural amount of catch-up growth that you do, and then you can't go any further and stagnation happens. It's not that straightforward or natural. If what happened to Japan's economy is a murder mystery, the United States did it. What we're doing to the Chinese economy today, this isn't something that I believe the United States should necessarily be blamed for. This is something that is inevitable, because the United States can only be so generous for so long. I don't want to be sounding incredibly jingoistic or America first-ish here, but I think it's a great accomplishment of the United States, the extent to which the Japanese and Chinese economies have developed, but it is definitely not something that has been awesome for the U.S. working class and
but
the U.S.
economy.
But I
don't think the America did it out of the goodness of their hearts. I think it's seen that they helped Germany so they weren't sort of plodding in the shadows, bitter of what happened. You know, they were wealthy and then happy, and then a good ally of America from there.
Well, it was all about the Cold War. And that's actually all about, that's the same deal with China, though it kept it. The Chinese economic opening happened in the mid to late 1970s. The massive reforms started after Mao's death in 1978. In an accelerating series of choices that had their genesis in the Nixon administration in the mid 1970s, the United States decided to help China. And for the first 15 years or so, we were explicitly doing that to strengthen China in its struggle with Russia. They were both communist countries, but for the last two decades of the Cold War, they were enemies, and China was on our side. So it's a very similar dynamic. Of course, we didn't help Japan and Germany out of the goodness of our heart, and we didn't help China out of the goodness of our hearts either. It was about competition. What happened in the United States in the 90s and the aughts was that a lot of U.S. elites figured out that they could benefit in the large way, and U.S. consumers to a degree as well, all the cheap goods that we got. But sort of the 80% of Americans that were not benefiting directly from Chinese production the way that the 20% that owns significant stockholdings does. We're not so happy. You know, the class, a cheaper fridge isn't that exciting if you can't get a job.
Well, it's not cheaper then because you don't have the money.
Exactly. So at a certain point, all of this is to say that at a certain point, it is natural that the United States says, okay, we're good. And because of the different natures of Japan and China, this is playing out in different ways. Japan didn't have many cards to play. China, frankly, doesn't have many cards to play either, but it has more cards than Japan did. Japan in the 1980s, entirely dependent on the United States for its security. This is still the case today. Japan,
but it's also very resource poor.
Yes. So it's dependent on U.S. defense, and it's also dependent on the U.S. guaranteeing that the Middle East can send a lot of oil and gas to Japan. So these are very important dynamics that are somewhat similar with China, but also quite different. Japan, despite its incredible economic footprint, especially in the 1980s, was not a military titan on the level, or perceived to be on the level of the Soviet Union. And was certainly, even back then, with its more constrained military in the 1980s, was a much bigger deal than China. But even back then, the Japanese were looking at China and saying, okay, they're going to be a bigger deal. So the Soviet Union was fading out, but, you know, still posed some threat to Japan. Japan and the Soviet Union shared a border and border disputes. This is still the case with Japan and Russia today.
And they never finalized World War II, is one of those little factoids you'll hear.
Yep. And that is still an ongoing problem with Russia and Japan today.
A string of islands.
Indeed. So Japan felt vulnerable because of the Soviet Union and had China coming up. So in the 1980s, when the United States started an escalating series of, this is directly from Money and Macro, in 1981, Reagan imposed a quota on the number of Japanese cars that could be imported in the United States. In 1983, he put a 45% tariff on motorcycles imported in the United States. And then in 1985, we have the Plaza Accords, which are something that I do not entirely understand. But are tremendously important in the end of the Japanese economic miracle. Essentially, what the Plaza Accords held was that the Bank of Japan would stop depressing the value of the Japanese yen, because if they made the yen cheaper with respect to the U.S. dollar, the Japanese exports would do better. So they basically agreed to, this is interesting, and the Plaza Accords involved Japan selling a whole ton of U.S. securities, so selling all their treasuries to make the yen more expensive. This is 1985. And that kind of scotched the Japanese economic map. Interestingly, in the short term, it looked great for Japan because the yen was appreciating massively and every Japanese person all of a sudden could buy much more with their salaries. So that actually took a sustainable, impressive series of large economic growth and then just absolutely supercharged it in the late 1980s. Inflated a massive real estate bubble. Things went absolutely crazy. And then it all sort of fell apart. And I think the concept that I finally got adequately explained to me by Richard Koo on the recent Odd Lots podcast is the concept of a balance sheet recession, which is also, it seems like it might be pretty important to do China right now, and was very important to the United States in the aftermath of 2008. So balance sheet recession is basically talking about the individual balance sheets of every consumer in the economy. Every participant in the economy. This is things start going poorly. Participants in the economy decide that they have too much debt, or they have too much, they don't have enough savings. They don't have They just decide that. They make decisions that are rational and good for them. That makes sense. You don't want people in the economy to be in too much debt more generally. But if everybody in the economy decides all at once that, I'm not going to take out those car loans. I'm not going to take out those house loans. I'm going to do what I can to sock money away because things look a little bit worse. The problem is if everybody does that at the same time, things just start looking worse and worse and worse. An ongoing problem for Japan, and was certainly the problem for the United States in the aftermath of 2008, and I think is probably the problem that China has right now, is that the government also takes that perspective, is unwilling to do the Keynesian work, is unwilling to say, well, okay, it seems like nobody in this economy wants to spend any money, so the government's going to have to start spending some money. If the government doesn't do that, then you can get what the Japanese got, which was a solid quarter century of stagnation.
So would it help if they did what we talked about in the last episode, where America was giving normal people money to encourage them to spend?
Rory, we can do even better than that hypothetical. We actually have a natural experiment. It's called Abenomics.
Okay.
Shinzo Abe, is there something where Japan recently changed their public naming conventions? Not like within Japan, but how they convey themselves diplomatically, like, because it used to be Abe Shinzo, and now it's Shinzo Abe.
First name, second name?
Yeah.
Did it change around? Okay.
I feel like they might have.
Because I've heard the Chinese do that.
Which leads to incredible confusion for me, because unfortunately at this moment, I can't tell you whether Abe is his first name.
Okay,
I
keep hearing it's Shinzo Abe, so.
Yeah, I think Abe is his family name and Shinzo might be his name. So I think we'll just go with Abe because they called it Abenomics. And what he did essentially it seems possibly successfully, though maybe COVID had more to do with this. There's some very interesting things happening with the Japanese economy in recent years that I have not researched at all. But I do know that when Abe, who was sadly recently assassinated.
Definitely in a country with very few gun deaths.
Yeah.
He was killed with a homemade gun.
Yeah, with very little connection to what he was actually doing when he was in charge of the country. He had given up power, I think because he was ill, actually, mid-Trump administration. And he was just doing some kind of stump speech for an upcoming election and was assassinated by a guy with a homemade gun. Strange. That is, I do not believe, connected to his somewhat transformative time as Prime Minister of Japan. And essentially with Abenomics, he was willing, among many, many other things, my understanding is that he was willing to do much, much more stimulus than anybody else was. And I do believe, so the great marker of Japanese stagnation was deflation. So inflation is bad above a certain amount. I think that most people want I think the Federal Reserve targets 2% of inflation.
Well, it's to be expected that inflation will happen.
Well, and it's also, I think, to a degree necessary for an economy. Like, if you don't have inflation, then what's the inspiration to make investments? You know, the whole point of buying a bond or securities or property is because you want to beat inflation. And if you could just have a pile of dollars that would be worth a pile of dollars 5 years or 10 years, 15 years from now, then what's the point, you know? So I think there's other economic reasons to have inflation that I couldn't tell you right now. But deflation is worse. Deflation means that basically your money gets more and more valuable. So you just want to hold on to the money and you don't want to spend it and you don't want to invest in anything. And if you have that, then you have what the Japanese had. And this is actually interesting. In the aftermath of 2008, U.S. and European central banks were also trying to bring about some level of inflation. That's what quantitative easing was about. Like, we don't want to fall into Japanese-style deflation. And because of the austerity fetish in European and U.S. governments, the governments weren't spending the money they needed to. So the central banks stepped in to do some of that work. I think that makes sense, but I don't know. I was basically being a parrot, just describing things that I've read, and I have no idea whether it actually makes any sense. So anyway.
Well, I think the issue with austerity is they were giving the money to the rich, and then they were kind of just hoarding it.
Yes, that is one of the many, many issues with austerity. So regardless, Japan had this deflation issue, which was a real problem for decades. And they now have inflation again.
So the only country happy to get inflation?
They're delighted, actually. Actually, with this inflation print we had, I guess, 2 weeks ago now in the United States when this airs, it's around 3% inflation, and that's a little bit higher than the inflation than the Federal Reserve targets. But that is actually, I think 2 to 3% is something that central bankers are pretty happy with. And basically, the Japanese getting back to 2 to 3% inflation means that finally, their economy is beginning to recover from what happened in the 1980s. So there are indications that China's going through things that look like this. A tremendous factor in Japan's deflation, population peaking. But the really terrifying thing for China is that Japanese population, this is straight from the Oddlots podcast, the Japanese population peaked in 2009 on like the end of their second decade, economic stagnation. And China's population has just peaked. So that's not a great indicator.
It does seem like their population will crater. It might have a lot to do with the one-child policy, which seemed to be unbelievably cruel when it's something that tends to happen with when people get wealthier is they have less children. So, well, the big doomsday prediction will be that by the end of the century, they will be down to 800 million. So America's population will be about 400 million then. So China's population will only be 2 Americas when it's now about 4.1.
Man, U.S. population is only 400 million by the end of the century, I'm going to be very disappointed.
What were you hoping for, 500?
Yeah, I think we should. Of course.
Half a billion has a nice ring to it.
Half a billion has a great ring to it, you know? I think
even though
it's
not
number.
A true billion, but that's a whole other topic.
I mean, I'd love it if we could make a billion by the end of the century, but I don't think that'll happen.
You'd need to do a lot more building if that's the plan.
I think we've got the space. We've got the space.
We do have the space. That's definitely true.
Definitely got the space. So there are many indicators that are very troubling for China. And to be clear, I think like Japanification is very distinct from just a normal China being a normal country. China could just have a normal country with normal growth, and that, you know, will almost certainly lead to a variety of political crises if that's the case. Japanification is sort of a bigger deal. If they were to just sort of hover in this stagnant period for decades, that would be a real problem for the world.
Much better than China collapsing.
But China, I don't think China's in any danger of doing that. What's interesting is that, and I think we've discussed this before, is that in 2008, China was actually the country that really stepped up in terms of stimulus spending. Adam Tooze, a much followed historian and commentator, has highlighted this really well in his a series of books, really, that in the aftermath of the 2008 crisis, China had the spare powder to be incredibly generous in
stimulus.
Well,
let's consider that China didn't really go through a recession when a lot of the world did.
Yes. And that's because they spent a massive, massive amount. They had all kinds of levers to pull that are unheard of in the Western world. There's just tremendous machinations that U.S. and European governments have gone through to try to get banks to lend more money in the aftermath of the great financial crisis. All China has to do is call up the bank and say, lend more money. That happened, a wide variety of other things happened. Not so individual focused, but in terms of investment, they were able to keep the the Chinese wheels spinning. And that was sort of the first real indicator. And this played into a lot of Chinese resentment, because it was true to a degree that China was doing the work of keeping the world economy spinning in the direct aftermath of 2008, whereas the United States and Europe really were not. But now, you know, China does not have the world reserve currency. It does not have the luxury to just sort of keep kicking the can down the road that the United States does.
It has been buying a lot of dollars, though.
Recently? I thought it was more switching towards gold or whatever.
Bit of both.
So in the aftermath of COVID, 2020, they have not been able to do the sorts of stimulus, or have they have decided that they are not capable of doing the sorts of stimulus that they did in 2008. And it's interesting, they, this was again from the Oddlots podcast, they apparently have a very, very low rate of inflation, but it is a troublingly low rate of inflation at this point.
So it could go a bit stagflationy?
Yeah, a bit deflationary, actually. Yeah, just the I think stagflation in the 1970s, that's high inflation, I thought. It's high inflation without economic growth, I think, is the definition of stagflation. So this is just, you know, just trending towards Japanification, I think, is the concern here. And it struck me, I don't think they said this on the Oddlots podcast, but just how many of the problems that China is dealing with right now seem very reminiscent of the problems that the United States was dealing with in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis. But there are a lot of things going in China's favor. I think the trade deficit between the United States and China in particular has been changing in the U.S.'s favor. But the overall U.S. trade deficit, even with all of the, I think it has improved a little bit because of the amount of gas we're selling. But the overall trade deficit in the United States hasn't improved that much. And China, unlike Japan, that at that point in time was pretty much, no, Japan could sell to the rest of the world as well. But their main bread and butter was selling to the United States and Europe in the 1980s. China does have other options. China is not, and this should go without saying, but it's worth saying, is not dependent for its security against China the way that Japan was. Yeah, it is. And there is no Chinese security threat that other than the United States. That's an overstatement. The main Chinese security threat is the United States. That is very different from the Japanese situation, where the United States was the main security guarantor and remains the main security guarantor for Japan. So China has a wider freedom of action.
But it's also, it neighbors the most amount of countries in the world, while, you know, Japan being an island did have more limited options.
I think that's true. And there's something else they emphasized in the podcast, was that we have now identified in multiple historic instances what a balance sheet recession is. It's pretty clear that the problems cropping up in China right now are similar in certain ways to the problems that cropped up in the United States after the 2008 financial crisis, and cropped up in Japan and persisted in Japan for decades. And it does seem that with sort of the Trump-Biden explosion of spending, and with the Abe Shinzo explosion of spending, it seems like there were solutions that were tried. And I think China has that opportunity. The key question is whether they're willing to take that opportunity. And I'm now getting way out of my comfort zone talking about things that an economist...
Well, I think you have to ask the main question, does it help the CCP? Because I think China would be happy to diminish in world standings if it means the Communist Party is still in charge. While if what you're suggesting empowers the average person, no.
Exactly. That is exactly the problem at this point. I think the Chinese Communist Party and Xi Jinping specifically are the problem at this point. And, you know, it doesn't have to be the way. I've been researching a little bit just the 1970s, 80s, 90s era of opening, and there were Chinese Communist Party figures who were making tremendously far-reaching decisions that did give more power to consumers and individuals. That is not Xi Jinping's Chinese Communist Party. So the answer for China, as it has been for the United States, is simply to give more money and more opportunities for normal people. And it really seems that throughout, this is going to Michael Pettis, who's an economist whose work I follow on Twitter, and I've read some of his articles, who makes a really compelling case that despite being a communist country or what have you, China has really all been over the past 40 years, has become much more successful by focusing on enriching the rich, by really focusing on making a smaller class of investors and business owners tremendously wealthy, because this small class is very easily controllable. Surprisingly, the way that Pettis talks about this is he actually calls it labor repression. The Chinese economic miracle has been bought by labor repression, by limiting the opportunities and the wages of Chinese workers, and making sure that a larger slice of that goes to the investors, goes to the factory builders, sacrificing individual success for the ability to build more factories, the ability to build more capital goods, and this, that, and the other thing. And it seems fairly straightforward that there are some basic things that China could do that have worked in the United States and Japan. Honestly, like, China doesn't really have much of a healthcare system. Or outside of a few institutions, I think that they absolutely have an education system, which is highly, highly valued, but there's a lot more that they could do. Honestly, it's funny to say this about a communist country, but if China did a lot more social spending, they might actually be able to benefit from the kinds of dynamics that the United States has benefited from so massively that we talked about last episode, that seemed to be creating a sort of U.S. economic miracle. But China just doesn't seem to be willing to do that yet. And I think that's the key question if we're trying to determine whether China is going to go on a Japan-style path.
And it is facing a massive old people problem.
Indeed.
Because there will be significantly less, you know, people of working age and a lot of older people to support.
No question. It's a cliche, but an important one. You know, has China gotten old before it's gotten rich?
Yeah.
And I think that is an interesting question. But I do think that once Xi Jinping is dealt with, there's a real...
Sounds very Black Ops, doesn't it?
No, I mean, it won't be me. It won't be the U.S. It won't be the United States. But once he shuffles off the stage, hopefully to a peaceful retirement, I think that China still has incredible resources, incredibly talented people inside and outside government that are very capable of...
Can you see a democracy movement growing at all?
I haven't seen anything like that, and I think that we'd certainly see a champion pretty quickly.
Because I've heard you speak very highly of other China.
Taiwan?
Yeah.
Yeah?
About how it's doing very well, and you could see that nearly if Taiwan and China united, but on the Taiwanese side of things, shall we say, that it could be an unstoppable force.
I have talked about that in the past, and wow, would that piss Washington, D.C. off. I don't see that, though. Those are more...
We should be good by the time this episode goes out that there won't be a democratic overthrow of China.
Yeah, I'm pretty confident that that won't be there. That won't happen. But hey, one never knows. One never knows. I don't see many near-term prospects for democracy in China, frankly. But what I do see is the potential, and they talk about this on the Odd Lots podcast as well, the potential for China to learn from previous examples. Specifically, Richard Kuo talks about being able to learn from the concept of a balance sheet recession and the necessity of the government to engage in some sorts of stimulus. They can learn what kinds of stimulus actually worked better. Every politically involved Chinese person would hate to hear this, but they can learn from Japan. Japan has been dealing with stagnating population and a more elder economy for over a decade now. And certainly Japan has done that from a position of higher GDP per capita. But that doesn't mean that there aren't lessons that China can apply in its own political economy. So I don't know. I'm not as pessimistic on China as many are. I do think they've got difficulties ahead of them. I do think that Xi Jinping has proven himself to be kind of a dead end and a poor choice. But I think China has tremendous potential. I think that the chances of China falling into a full-scale, quarter-century-long Japan-style stagnation are pretty low. But it's possible, and it's definitely worth watching.
So if this podcast becomes very popular in China and you become the president of China, what changes would you go for?
Man, that's a... Closing off with a big question, sorry. man, if I were in charge of China, and it seems basic, but I would not focus on the nationalism so much. I think that as terrible a frap a war over Taiwan is for the United States, I think it's infinitely worse for the Chinese, and I don't think the Chinese have any intention of invading Taiwan this decade, but I do know that the way that the Chinese government plays with it for nationalist points with the local public is a serious risk of that. I would just say prioritize individuals, you know, go read Michael Pettis. I intend to read more Michael Pettis. It was a fascinating article in The Economist recently talking about, I believe the city of Chengdu, which might be in the Sichuan province, that is apparently managing to avoid a lot of the real estate woes that the rest of the economy is experiencing for some dynamics that are just, it's a more successful city for unreplicable reasons. But just doing really basic stuff. I think we are all aware that the Chinese real estate market is falling apart. One of the aspects of this is that people just aren't getting their apartments that they've already started paying a mortgage for, because the builders get in some kind of financial trouble, so they just stop building. Chengdu, or the regional government in charge of Chengdu, they started stepping in to make sure that the apartments that people had paid for got built. And that seems to be the main reason why they have a healthier real estate market than anybody else in China. And it's just that simple consumer focused, you know, it's a communist country, folks. Why not actually help the people occasionally, you know?
Well, this is something you hear as a benefit of China is quite often they'll implement policies, different policies all over China, and a lot of them might fail or be completely corrupt. But if one or two work, then it's like, okay, we can then apply that for the rest of them.
Yeah, and I think that's a real failing of the Xi Jinping era, is that the sort of, in the U.S. we call it laboratories of democracy, but I suppose laboratories of autocracy approach is really, really fading, because one of the things I really respected about China before Xi was that it was... it seemed like they had sort of a corporatist model with like folks who are sort of pulling in the same direction, but you know, regular changes of power, and we know what we're doing, but we have the scope for individual success and applying that innovation. And as China, you know, seems to be falling further and further into this neo-Mao hogwash, it's not great. So yeah, I think if I were premier of China, the most important thing I would do is say that nobody should pay any attention to Rob Morris Thought or whatever. You know, Xi Jinping Thought is supposedly like the new big thing. I'd try to be more of a ding, I guess, and you know, try to drop in occasionally with a pithy aphorism and mostly tour factories and be like, hey, this is nifty. This is cool. I like it. I like what you're doing. Let's do more of what you're doing. That's a tremendous oversimplification of Deng Xiaoping, and I apologize. I should probably end every podcast with an apology.
Probably.
Yes, yes, I thought will we leave every episode with a thought?
Like Rob Morris thought? Like a pithy aphorism?
No, just put in she's thoughts.
She's thoughts. Ah, well, man, that would require reading Xi Jinping thought, which I'm really not eager to do.
So what you're saying is you'd like America to be a bit more state-focused and China to be a bit more individualist?
You know, I feel like... No, I'd like China to be a little more communist, man. Like, give some stuff to the people, you know? I think that'd be a good... give some back to the people instead of just the rich investors who are paying court in Beijing. That'd be my recommendation.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us on this episode, and we'll catch you next time.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire: What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.